Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. It's my great pleasure to be here chairing the inaugural lecture of Professor David Marston. I should also say before I talk about David, it's good to see Ben Roberts here. A great name in initial relations, and Ralph Turvey, two of the great names in the past of London School of Economics. David Marston is somebody I, although we have worked together for 20 years, I first heard of him not in this country, but in Europe. Very typical that he is very well known for his work on very innovative aspects of industrial relations. He did his first degree at Oxford, and then he did his PhD at the University of Aix-Marseille, and it was très honorable, which I think at least one could expect from someone like him. He has been a consultant to UK government as well as the Danish government, where he was part of a think tank on social cohesion. He has worked for the OECD, wrote a very influential report on the impact of industrial relations and management practices on unemployment in OECD countries. He is a founder editor of a journal, Industrial Weltbildung, which is bad German pronunciation on my part, but it's a German journal of industrial relations. He has been a founder editor since 1993. I have always found David Marston's work very imaginative and sort of bit of lateral thinking, because it cuts across industrial relations, organization theory, sociology, and economics. And he's always been concerned with the title of his lecture is, Can the Right Kind of Labor Institution Create Jobs? And I expect that he will tell us, among other things, about his latest book, which is called A Theory of Employment Systems, Micro Foundations of Social Diversity, Societal Diversity. And I've been told to say that the book will be on sale after the inaugural lecture till 8 o'clock or later in the evening at the bookshop. Okay, David Marston.
Well, thank you very much for coming here this evening. It's always something of an honor to give a lecture like this, and I'm very pleased to see so many people here. I've chosen for a topic this evening something which has puzzled me and many other people for a long time, and that is, can the right kind of labor institutions help create jobs? If we think back to the conventional wisdom of the 1980s, I suppose the automatic answer would be no, they can't. And at best, one can hope that labor institutions, which could be trade unions, labor laws, collective bargaining, any of these other collective actions within labour markets. At best, they might be neutral in their effect on jobs. At worst, they could cause a great deal of damage and a great deal of job loss. With that in mind, it was something of a surprise to read the study by the OECD a couple of years ago, which suggested that as they reviewed all of the literature on employment protection and various other measures like that, that it seemed that there was perhaps some effect, but not a particularly strong effect. And for all of the debates which had gone on in the OECD in the years before, this was perhaps a very muted conclusion to arrive at. Of course, I think one reason for arriving at that conclusion is that the 1980s debate framed the question about labour institutions and employment and about the general influence of labour institutions in a very negative light. I think one could think about institutions and labour laws in two ways. One can think of them in a negative sense as a constraint, but one could think of them also in a positive sense as creating a framework which enables people, enables in this case firms and workers, to do things that perhaps they couldn't otherwise do. And I'd like to argue this evening that the employment relationship is of that kind, that it is an institution which has evolved partly out of the interaction between individual firms and individual workers, partly under the action of labour law and of collective bargaining. But it's an institution which enables workers and firms to come together in a cooperative venture in a way that perhaps they couldn't otherwise do. And the employment relationship, I think, could be compared in many ways to the development of the limited liability company. The limited liability company created huge possibilities for the financing of economic organization. In the same way, I'd like to argue that the employment relationship created the possibility for firms to mobilize large numbers of workers in often very complex production and service operations. And that this in many ways is one of the basic institutions of the great economic expansion of the last 100 years. But what is special about the employment relationship? One of its most remarkable features is that it's open-ended, both in its duration and in the content of the work that's to be undertaken. It creates a framework of obligations between workers and employers, and then leaves management free to define the tasks that workers will undertake ex post after the agreement has been entered into. One might contrast this with the situation that would arise if one were to hire the services of a self-employed builder, where if you're wanting an extension built to your house, or the roof repaired or something like that, you have to agree a set of operations beforehand, and you set up, you agree a price, and you agree a set of outcomes that you want achieved by the builder. The roof we put on, the extension built, but all of this is done beforehand, ex ante. The employment relationship allows much greater flexibility, because often it's very difficult to define exactly what you need before you enter into a contract. Now, the, if you like, evidence of the success of the employment relationship is that if one looks across the OECD countries today, roughly 9 workers out of 10 are engaged as employees. About 10% are engaged as self-employed, and even most part-time workers are engaged in open-ended contracts, even though they work for rather shorter hours. Now, the employment relationship is a fairly recent development. If we look back to some of the studies of the 19th century, other forms of work organization, other forms of contracting between workers and firms were extremely common. Mottes, a French sociologist who wrote a magnificent and magisterial summary of the work on the development of pay systems and employment systems in France and in the United States, spoke about the transition towards the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century from the enterprise as a business, as he put it, towards the enterprise as an employing organization. And this in a way captures the transition from a multitude of often very ingenious forms of labor contracting towards the dominance of the open-ended employment relationship, which most of us in this room are engaged in. Now, one of the remarkable things about the employment relationship is that it enables people to cooperate together under conditions in which you would expect cooperation to be extremely difficult. Most workers and most firms are self-interested. We don't work for charity, not even for the greater glory of the LSE. We know that our interests often diverge with those of our employers. Also within that relationship, there are imbalances of knowledge. Skilled workers know more about the process of work. The employer often knows more about the product market, and maybe also about the state of the labor market, and about related processes that person might be engaged in. Also, each party knows that the other party would incur costs if the relationship were ended. So there's lots of scope for opportunistic action by both sides, and in that sense, one might think that achieving cooperation would be really rather difficult. Why not go back to the various forms of subcontracting that prevailed through the 19th century? If you read some of the economists that Mertes cites in his great study, there were many enthusiasts. One economist, Leroy Beaulieu, spoke about the subcontracting system as meaning that the eye of the master was everywhere, a very good way of controlling work and so on, and dealing with just these kinds of opportunistic actions. So how is it that the employment relationship solves those problems? Well, I've hinted a little bit at the advantages that there might exist for employers. Coase, again in another very famous article that has been very much quoted, suggested that the employment relationship provided the employer the freedom to define the work that the worker should do within certain limits. And I think he chose his words very carefully. And one could see that from an employer's point of view, the employment relationship could be extremely useful, saving on defining the exact contract until you know exactly what you need. But what about those limits? Surely an open-ended relationship in which there weren't any limits would be a recipe for exploitation of the workers who were engaged in it. And if that were the case, why should any workers ever want to provide their services as employees? So the way in which those limits on the employment relationship and on the obligations within it, the way in which those limits are established is, I'd argue, something which is extremely important. It is fundamental, I think, to our understanding of the employment relationship. Unless there's an effective way of setting the limits to employees' obligations, no employees would agree to workers. No workers would agree to function as employees, and certainly not 90% of the workers in OECD countries. Well, I'd like to say a few quick words about the nature of work rules which help to limit employees' obligations. And then I'd like to look at the potential limits that this kind of relationship may have encountered, and then try and explore some of the implications of those. But if I could just say a few words about the way in which the limits are established. I'll just give some examples of common work rules. These are illustrations. One could think of the maybe just take the first one, the work post rule. This is a very common way of establishing the limits to employees' obligations to their employers. The employer divides the work tasks in a particular enterprise into discrete packages, and each of these are assigned to an individual worker who's responsible for carrying them out. This has been very common in bureaucratic work organization in France and also in the United States. And the dividing up the work in this way does give management control, but equally defining jobs also helps to delimit workers' obligations to their employers. People know what the boundaries of their jobs are, and in that sense they can begin to identify when those boundaries might be transgressed. Another example, again a very widespread in one of the earlier types of work rule, the job territory or tools of the trade work rule, one that's been very common in British trade union history. Here the idea would be that employees and employers can define the scope of the jobs for which people are hired by the types of tools or the types of materials which are used. Only the electrician can use the electrician screwdriver, and certain tasks involve the use of that screwdriver belong to electricians. Other people aren't allowed to do those. But you can define the scope of a job by reference to the type of tools or the type of materials which are used. And in that way, too, boundaries can be established. And historically, the work post and the job territory or tools of the trade rule have been very important. One important feature of them is that they tend to focus on the task and the allocation of tasks between different workers. Perhaps more modern forms focus rather on the function. One could think of the competence rank rule, which is very common in Japanese companies, which ranks workers according to the complexity of tasks that they can carry out, and then uses that as a principle for organizing work flexibly within work groups. But at the same time, the rule gives structure to the work organization and to the work group, and this gives workers then some degree of control over the way management can use their labor. The other example, the qualification rule, is very common in Germany, whereby work tasks are identified according to the skill requirements that they bring, and then work of a particular kind is handed to workers who hold the requisite qualifications to undertake that. And when the qualifications are well established, as they are in German firms, through the apprenticeship system, then it's easy to identify who should get certain kinds of work and to identify when that work doesn't go to those people, but also to identify when the people who are skilled receive work which isn't their type of work. And all of these rules, I think, which are very widely diffused, help to give workers guidance in the allocation of work within the employment relationship. So the employer gets flexibility, but the workers have principles which enable them to establish the limits of their obligations. The rules may look very simple, but when you think about it, any kind of work rule has to be simple if the employment relationship is to maintain its flexibility. The rules have to be such that ordinary workers and ordinary line managers can apply them. You can't afford to call in the personnel department or call in outside experts to settle disputes all the time. They have to be things which can be used very easily and very quickly. Now, with the development of these kinds of rules which help to solve the problem which Coase left in the dark, that is establishing the limits to the employment relationship, one can imagine the employment relationship spreading in two ways. One is out of a piecemeal interaction between workers and firms in different environments. Gradually these rules evolve out of a kind of experimentation process, and the successful ones diffuse and become accepted, unsuccessful attempts are eliminated. But also the development of, certainly historically, the development of labor law and of collective bargaining have also played an important part in spreading these work rules and in reinforcing them and making them easier for workers to apply in different environments. Now, I said that the employment relationship had been very successful, I would argue, largely because it did provide a way of enabling both workers and employers to police the limits of their obligations. But one could ask, really, whether the employment relationship has now reached the end of the road. And this is where I think the work by the group of experts that was chaired by Alain Supiot, a French labor lawyer, are extremely interesting. Unlike many left-wing labor lawyers, who perhaps one has heard in the past defending the status quo within labor law and fighting any attempts to dilute the protections it provides to employees, Alain Supiot and his colleagues said, well, let's look at the protections offered by the employment relationship and by labor law. Let's also look at the pressures on firms as they're operating in increasingly in global markets and with fast-changing technology. And let's try and think very deeply about the way in which the employment relationship and employment law need to be changed in order to adjust to that. So a first question that Alain Supiot and his colleagues, I see Pam Meadows, who is also one of the members of the team who worked with him, she's here. A first question that Supiot asked was, are there ways in which the employment relationship and employment law can be made more responsive to these pressures? They also asked another question, and that was whether the attempts to try and dilute the employment relationship's rules up until now had been very successful. There has been, of course, as we all know, a great deal of piecemeal adaptation of employment law. Just again thinking of the work that Alain Supiot did in France, but one could see similar things in England and other European countries. The development of special contracts for people on government schemes, employment and training contracts, maybe one sees a greater proliferation of these in France, where the law plays a bigger role. But all of these special types of contract, in a way, were designed to try and create steps between non-employment and employment so that firms could hire particular categories of workers more easily and without the full protections of the standard employment contract. Scipio looked at these attempts to try and make the employment relationship more flexible and suggested that they had been very ineffective. There was not a lot of evidence that they'd boosted jobs and boosted the employment possibilities of the workers concerned. But on the downside, there was an important cost, and that is that this myriad of different contracts was diluting the simplicity of the employment contract. Again, remember what I said earlier about the importance of work rules and employment rules being very simple, because otherwise ordinary workers and ordinary line managers can't operate them. But by making the employment contract much more complicated with all these different exceptions and different categories, Scipio argued that this was in a way undermining the basic protections of the employment relationship, but not bringing any benefits in terms of better employment. That was the second problem that they raised. There's also another reason for wondering about the future of the employment relationship. And that is, there is a puzzle in the evidence that we face at the moment. I mentioned the conflict between case study and statistical evidence. There's a lot of work being done at the company level which highlights the need that firms have for greater flexibility of one form or another. Firms want to enter into new activities, move out of activities if those don't work. They don't just want necessarily to downsize, but they want to change their structures and change the composition of their workforce to follow the changing composition of their activities. That implies a rather different relationship between the firm and the workforce to that which we have in mind when we think of traditional car factories or banks or organizations of that kind. Also, a lot of organizations are thinking of trying to develop network patterns of organizing rather than the traditional structures, traditional hierarchical structures that they had. There are attempts, I mean many others. Charles Handy gives us a great list of different types of organization structure which firms try to develop. A lot of these geared to trying to respond to more swiftly moving markets and to more swiftly moving technologies. If we look at workers' perceptions of the security that their firms give them, there too we find a lot of evidence that people believe they are less secure in their jobs than they were previously. Perhaps with the traditional employment relationship went the idea that if you worked reasonably well, you had a job for as long as you wanted. If you wanted it for life, maybe you had it for life. Mehnad was commenting just before we started that both of us had been here rather a long time, even with the abolition of tenure. it may even be lifetime by the time we finish. But in a lot of employments, employees feel that old implicit understanding between themselves and their firms has been eroded. And all of that would seem to point to firms trying to move away or wanting to move away from the traditional open-ended, open-duration employment relationship. On the other hand, when we look at the statistical evidence at the aggregate level, again, I refer to work by the OECD, we find that job tenures have proved remarkably stable through the periods of downsizing and through the employment changes of the 1980s. Also, work by colleagues in the CEP suggests that in Britain too, job tenures have been much more stable than one would expect had all these predictions about flexible organizations been true. Likewise with self-employment, a lot has been spoken about self-employment and how we all becoming consultants rather than lecturers, or consultants rather than managers. But there too, if we look at the OECD figures on self-employment, there's no clear international trend one way or the other. Overall, in some countries there were big changes, others there weren't. Some it's gone up, some it's gone down, but there's no sign of a kind of great imminent collapse of the open-ended employment relationship. So what's the problem? Is it that the case studies are unrepresentative? Or is it that the statistics are measuring the wrong things? Or is it that there's perhaps something else which is at work? And here I'd like to speculate and suggest that perhaps what is behind all this is a pent-up demand among firms for different kinds of relationship with their employees, a pent-up demand for alternative forms of employment relationship, alternatives to the traditional open-ended, open-duration contract. Now, if we think back to the arguments I presented earlier about the development of the employment relationship, I argued that its growth depended enormously on the ability to work out ways in which the limits of employees' obligations could be fixed. As I said, no employees would agree to unlimited obligations or unlimited managerial authority. So maybe there's something there which is, if you like, blocking the mechanism or blocking the change. Employers would like to have more flexible systems. Paul Osterman argues this at great length in his recent edited book, but they haven't found a way of offering employees sufficient guarantees and sufficient protections to make these alternatives sufficiently attractive. And in the meantime, there's a blockage because nobody wants to work in the grey area in between being an employee and being self-employed. Scipio discusses a number of possibilities in between the self-employed and the employed relationships. I won't say a great deal about them, but I think they're worth mentioning for their interest, because we will be organizing a seminar on the Scipio report later on this year, or sorry, next this academic year. But what he and his colleagues considered were a number of ways in which one could combine employment protection with a system in which people change jobs or change employers fairly frequently. He and his colleagues were thinking primarily about labor law, or therefore thinking about the protections of labor law and the protections of social insurance. And how could these be made transferable if you're moving from one firm to another? If your firm doesn't want to keep you for more than 2 or 3 years, how can you develop a system of labor protection which makes short duration jobs attractive to employees? And there are a number of alternatives they considered. Activity contracts was one of them. This was the idea that employees might be covered legally and through social insurance during periods of non-employment, perhaps thinking of voluntary activities or domestic household activities, recognized activities of one kind or another. They weren't too keen on that, but it was one of the options that they considered. Another option was the Italian idea of parasubordination, whereby people could work for several employers part-time, but doing so simultaneously. But this could be treated from the point of view of labor law and from the point of view of social insurance as continuous employment rather than or as continuous full-time employment rather than a series of individual jobs, which you'd often lose out from the point of view of employment protection because you're not with the employer for long enough to qualify for a number of protections. You're not there for 2 years, therefore you can't qualify for certain forms of protection against unfair dismissal or parental leave rights and various other things like that. And that would be one solution to that. Another one they considered was the idea of social drawing rights, that people could be entitled to, say, periods of leave during their careers for things like retraining or re-equipping themselves. Those are a number of options that they considered. And all of them, as I said, geared to trying to enlarge the area between traditional employment and traditional self-employment. I'd like to say a few words on the question of work rules and how these also might be changed, because it seems to me that while I think Scipio and his colleagues did a tremendous job in rethinking the pattern of employment and employment law for the future, they underestimated the importance of the rules which employers and workers develop spontaneously as they bargain and as they interact with each other. And looking at these, I think, gives some clues as to where the future might lie. First of all, I'd say that the crisis of employment that Scipio and his colleagues, and also Paul Osterman and others, identify, I think is very much a crisis of the enterprise-based employment model. If you think back to the four work rules I outlined at the beginning, two of those, the work post and the Japanese model, were very much enterprise-based rules. They were dividing up work within an enterprise. But the other two, the tools of the trade and the qualification rule, were much more rules associated with occupations and regulating work done by people belonging to certain occupations. So I mentioned the example of the electrician screwdriver in the case of the tools of the trade rule. But equally the German one, again, was something associated with clearly identified occupations. And here I think the crisis is much less severe. And indeed the employment rules are very much adapted to this idea, which has been touted very much by a number of people, of employability. Employability in the jargon refers to the ability of workers to find alternative employment when their current employer no longer needs them. And so we're thinking about people who would be developing skills which could be used in a number of different enterprises. Now, I'm a bit skeptical about a lot of the claims of employability that employers make on behalf of the programs they operate. In Britain, I guess we've seen apprenticeship wither because employers are unwilling to pay for transferable skills on the whole. And so when employers here promise employability, I'd like to see something rather concrete rather than just the promise. But nevertheless, I think if we think about the problems of more flexible structures that firms need, we need to think about the employability types of work rules, or the rules which are compatible with employability. And here I think we can learn something from looking at current developments and also looking back at the past. If we think about current developments, if one looks at the areas of work where self-employment has grown in Britain in recent years, it's been partly among casual labour, where people are unskilled and are really just basically selling their labour power in a very crude sense. Or alternatively, it's been occurring where there are professional or craft skills involved. I think it is very significant, the latter category, that self-employment has been growing where there is already a well-developed structure which defines the kind of work which people do, and both in terms of what people think they're going to provide to their employer and what they think that their employer will ask from them. But let's look at one or two examples going back in history. 19th century craft labour markets were very much labour markets in which employability was the name of the game. Just to take one example, the labour market for shipbuilding, which existed when shipbuilding in Britain was at its peak, was something which was very much focused something which in modern parlance would be described as a project basis of organization. Workers were hired for a particular ship, which isn't very different from people being hired for a particular project, to develop a software project or develop a new film or something like that. So when we talk about a project basis of work organization, there are historical precedents. It's also worth remembering that at the time that British shipbuilding was organized in this way, the Japanese were sending delegations to Scotland to find out how efficiently British shipbuilding or Scottish shipbuilding in those days was organized. And this, of course, rested very much on a system of craft labor markets where workers acquired transferable skills and also where they developed a set of craft norms which enabled them to identify the categories of work they could do, and they knew what their employer expected from them, or they knew what they expected to provide to their employer. So there's a well-regulated system of work organization that went with the craft labor markets. And this, I think, was at the time a very successful pattern of organization. Now, we can't answer the modern problems by looking backwards all the time, but there are some very interesting modern examples, I think, where there are new forms of employment relationship developing which merit closer attention. And here I'd look at some of the modern occupational communities, as they've been called. And two very interesting cases here are Hollywood and Silicon Valley. I use Silicon Valley in very broad terms because there are lots of Silicon Valleys in the US, so I'm not talking about any one in particular. Now, both of these are world beaters. In Europe, we're so terrified of Hollywood that our son adores so much because he loves Disney and all the other films and things that come from Hollywood. In Europe, we're so terrified of Hollywood's efficiency that we want to erect barriers of all kinds to protect our own European culture against this nasty American virus which is being sent across to us. So they're world-beating industries, not sort of interesting anecdotes about cottage industries of one kind or another. Now, neither Silicon Valley nor Hollywood have the traditional kind of professional or craft labor market. But what they do seem to have is a system whereby they can organize work on a project basis very often, pull a variety of highly qualified and highly talented people together, organize them in a way which convinces the workers involved that they're protected enough from potential opportunism by their employers or by their fellow workers. And maybe there's something there that we should look at. How is it that these forms of cooperation are feasible when we know that people in these industries are just as likely to be opportunistic as in any other of the industries that we're familiar with? Well, there hasn't been a great deal of research. There's been lots written, but not a lot of original research. But such as we have seen suggests that social networks of one kind or another play an extremely important part in these two cases. Now, social networks are very important because if you rat on an agreement and prove your unreliability, it's very important that other people should know about it. If you do this in a very atomistic, very competitive market, then probably no one will hear about it because You discount what other people tell you because you don't believe them. And in any case, there's no particular structure for conveying that information. But if you've got a well-established social network of people who know each other, perhaps they went to the same college, perhaps they've worked on previous projects together, there's a mechanism by which bad reputation, just as much as good reputation, can be transmitted. And what I'd like to suggest, and I'd be very interested in further evidence on this, is that these networks and reputation fulfill some of the same functions that the more traditional kind of work rules that I'd mentioned earlier on fulfilled in supporting the employment relationship. Now, I did suggest that we could keep some time for the questions. 6:30 is a difficult time to come to a lecture. So what I'd like to do is to conclude and then to keep about 10 minutes or so for questions from the audience. And what I'd like to think about at the end is what can be done to expand the middle ground between traditional employment relationship and traditional forms of self-employment. As I suggested earlier, I think both of these traditional patterns have reached their limits, or the strong reason to think that they've reached their limits. And if we're wanting to look for a new source of employment activity for people, then we need to think about institutional patterns that can release the potential in this area so that new types of activity can be developed and can flourish, which are neither traditional self-employment nor traditional employment. One line of analysis has already been suggested by Scipio and his colleagues, that we need to look at different ways of establishing labor law and people's entitlement to protections from labor law. Similarly, for social insurance. The same question, I think, arises in the realm of collective bargaining. Are there types of bargain, types of agreement that can be worked out that would be well adapted to protecting workers in this intermediate area between, as I said, traditional employment and traditional self-employment. But I think we also need to think about the kinds of rules which are developing in areas such as Hollywood and Silicon Valley. It's probably a mistake to try and learn too much from traditional craft labor markets and traditional professional labor markets. These offer some elements of employability, but they probably also offer a number of rigidities, because professions, as we all know, are very jealous of their territory and their area of expertise. And then I think the question is partly what can we learn from Hollywood and Silicon Valley and other cases like this, but also if we do learn something, what forms of institution could be developed that would encourage these developments rather than stand in their way. And if we look at these areas, I wouldn't say that the mechanisms of cooperation, the networks and the enforcement of reputation in Silicon Valley and Hollywood are the only reason why these sectors have become world beaters. But I think it's the role that these mechanisms play in facilitating new forms of economic organization and new forms of cooperation play a very important part in the success of these branches. And in that sense, I'd like to conclude by saying that I think that the right kinds of labor institutions can play a very important part in helping to create jobs. Thank you very much.
Now, I explained to David that it's very unusual for inaugural lecture to be followed by questions. But he would like to turn this into a different kind of inaugural lecture, a new form of inaugural lecture, so why not? I shall refrain from speaking about this. I have lots and lots of things to ask you, because I really think the audience should have some questions to ask you. Yes, gentlemen back there.
I'd like to put the point that governments are not the solution to the problem, but they are the problem. If you go back to taking the gentleman's examples on Hollywood and Silicon Valley, if you go back to the early 70s, the problems that were caused by the National Insurance Act, when people were in fact self-employed on a project basis, they had to then form a limited company, which was extremely costly and was putting them into a position that they didn't want to be in. Or they had to work through a third party, and therefore that third party became responsible for their employment. So if the numbers of people doing a particular type of self-employed work on a project basis is then the law relating to that is repealed by the government, then you regress rather than progress.
Yeah, thank you. I'll take one more question if there is, because we can have two or three questions simultaneously. Yes. A mic here, please.
I just wanted to ask whether Hollywood and Silicon Valley both have a certain kind of...
Can you hold the mic close to yourself?
Both have a certain kind of labor requirement. It's not the sort that you probably need maybe in manufacturing activity. And I was wondering whether you think this sort of employment relationship that you describe is possible to be sustained in more...
in services or in more traditional manufacturing as well. Okay. Richard McCree.
Thanks. I just wonder whether you would see any correlation between the form of work organization that you're positing and the kind of reward systems that people would then be remunerated by, rather than a traditional industrial wage. Is it all payment by results?
Okay, why don't you take those four questions?
Thank you very much. I'm sure the first question about national insurance is right, and one does need to look very carefully at the way in which existing social security regulations affect the ability of people to organize their work and to organize their economic activity in particular ways. And those are perhaps rather good examples of the convolutions that people had to go through to try and work effectively given the particular state of rules in this area. And I think that in that sense, the group who worked with Supia were really very much on the ball when they saw the importance of reforming social insurance, not abolishing it, but reforming it to make it better adapted to new forms of economic organization. So I'd agree with you, really, and the question is not to repeal laws, but to adapt them in a way which fits better with the types of organization people want to develop. On the question about whether these thoughts are relevant only to the media and to computing and software, I know that the European Commission has high hopes for the media industry to replace manufacturing as a major employer. Clearly, there's much greater scope for these patterns of organization where you've got highly skilled and highly qualified and often highly talented people to bring together. But one has to recognize also that a lot of the traditional manufacturing jobs are disappearing, that employment in these activities is growing fairly fast, and the educational levels across the advanced industrial economies are generally rising. And these together, I think, greatly increase the areas of employment where this kind of working is likely to be relevant. I think too the pressures of rapid technical change, the pressures of adjusting quickly to changing markets, also are pushing firms to looking for much more flexible patterns of organization than the traditional type of large single unit employer. On the last question about the reward systems, that I think is an extremely interesting area. One of the ways in which the Hollywood networks function owes, I think, very much to the type of reward system which is developed. There's a very interesting study done of the Screen Actors Union and the role it plays in organizing the payment of artists for what they call residual rights. I suppose if you think of a Disney film, this is my obsession at the moment, having a four-year-old who wants a new video every time they go to Sainsbury's, you could think of the rewards that go to the artists who create the film as one step, but then there are all the Disney t-shirts and the Tarzan t-shirts and yogurts and everything else, which bring in a very significant proportion of revenues, these residual rights. And in the case of the study of the Screen Actors and other unions, the revenues of their members came something like 60% from box office and 40% from the residual rewards. And I'd have thought one very important thing about project basis work is if it's developing things which are copyrighted or in which intellectual rights are vested, then it's likely that these revenues are going to play an increasingly important part. And what was very interesting in the Hollywood case was that the way in which, if you thought of the incomes of the actors, the box office receipts would come in a big lump, concentrated in a very short period. But in the periods between projects or between films or whatever else it was, the residual income provided a steady background stream of income that came in. So it played a very important part in smoothing the revenue flows of workers, which is a problem that one has in self-employment and any kind of very flexible activity. We've got children who need to be fed every day, houses that need to be paid for every day, and we can't always manage these with very unpredictable large sums of money that may come or may not come. So this income continuity, I think, was a very important part of it. And I should think that if one has copyright and things like software or maybe writing books and things like academic books, probably not, but royalty revenues could be an important aspect.
Well, let me say, you know, while listening to David's lecture, I kept on sort of playing a game about this. I said, I can explain all this, and there's no problem here. I'm an economist, I can explain all this. And I went on playing with the transaction cost model, how far I could go around just thinking it's all a matter of transaction costs, monitoring costs, hiring costs, firing costs. And there is something to be done here. I'm sure David is one of the better people to do it, is to whether, and he mentioned Ronald Coase's work, whether what we really are saying is that the transaction costs concept in economics are far too static and far too one-off, and what we need to think of is some kind of dynamic stochastic context of transaction costs. I was reminded of, when he's talking about Hollywood, I was reminded of a book by David Putnam. It's a very good book. It's called Movies and Money. And he more or less makes a 100-year comparison of Hollywood against Europe. And he makes a very, very interesting remark. He said, Hollywood treated films as an industry, and Europe treated films as an art form. And you know, one was handicraft and sort of, you know, a sort of cozy little permanent relationship. Other was just an industrial operation. And that by itself is a very, very interesting contrast. And of course, when you talked about the project style management, the fact that studios broke up, studios were a way of avoiding project management and the project and sort of, you know, doing a continuous employment guarantee. But that proved to be uneconomical. And it's very interesting that while a lot of the European emphasis today is on creating permanent jobs and things like that, in Hollywood, a permanent job arrangement broke up because quite a lot of people found that they were tied into a thing in which the possibility of making large gains by being independent, you know, was not sufficiently compensated for by the permanence of employment. And I think this is another interesting aspect. So I'm sure, like me, you all had lots and lots of thoughts excited in you, having heard David. And I think we look forward to many more creative things from him as part of London School of Economics. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you.